You're listening to New Churches Podcast, a production of Send Network on newchurches.com. We discuss all things church planting. If you're looking to take your next step toward multiplication, you're in the right place. newchurches.com provides relevant and reliable resources for church planters, church multipliers, and disciple makers. Our growing library features pastors, planters, and church leaders like Ed Stetzer, David Platt, Trillia Newbell, Christine Hoover, Dahati Lewis, Trevin Wax, and many others.
Hey, we're here at another episode of the newchurches.com podcast. By the way, just to remind you, newchurches.com is just all free resources. And that's the whole point of it, right? So everything, there's classes there, there's all kinds of other resources there. So don't think of yourself. This is not like the podcast. It's not a lost leader into some other resources that are for sale. The more you go down the rabbit hole, the more free church planting resources there ultimately are. So our episode today, we're going to be talking about rural church planting as well. My guest is Will Basham. He was born and raised in West Virginia, which just perfect for the beginning. He married his high school sweetheart, Amanda. They have five children. Will holds a master's degree in theological studies, and he has planted New Heights Church in Milton, West Virginia in 2012. Now, I want you to know that I know that some of you will listen to the first few seconds of the podcast and say, rural, I'm not rural, I'm not going to listen. Okay, get it. But what I want you to know is that we can actually learn from one another. And I think it'd be helpful for us to do so because a lot of the conversation that is in and around the rural situation does reflect kind of similarly to some conversations in urban situations and more. And we see this kind of people respond to cultural contexts differently on the context, but similarly in the midst of the broken world in which we all live. So why don't you stick around, have this conversation with us as well. Will, so glad to have you. We've done a couple of things together over the years, so thankful to talk about rural church planting with you today.
Yeah, it's good to be on the podcast. Thanks for hosting and having me, and yeah, good to connect with you again.
Good, good, good. Okay. So first of all, for a lot of people, you know, they don't rural America and is just, or rural North America is just new to them. And for a lot of people after the election of Donald Trump in 2016, they all of a sudden said, wait, what's this rural America? And then people were sort of interested in it. Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance kind of caught a lot of people's interest and attention as well. But I think when people realize that, depending how you count, you know, 46, 60 million, if you go to North America, people live in rural North America. And it's not, you know, I would say that sometimes, I mean, if I could be blunt, even some Christian leaders sort of see that as like flyover country. That's not a subtweet at Tim Keller, just so we're clear. Because you know, I remember I had a conversation with Tim Keller about rural ministry, and he just happened to have this call in his life. But so here's my question for you. Why should we care about rural America? The stats tell us that people are moving away from rural America, not to rural America. So why not just go where the people are going? Why care about rural America?
Yeah, I think if we're people of the book, we have to value what God values, and God values people. We believe in the Imago Dei, and that means wherever people are, then that is a high place of value. So when guys like me emphasize rural mission and church planting, it's not to the detriment of planting churches in urban centers or anything like that. It's just saying, hey, these places matter as well. When I was being assessed as a church planter, I had to answer the question so many times, why would you plant a church in such a small town? And I got tired of hearing it, but it was just like, I don't think I'm talented enough to plant in a big city. That was my main answer. But it was, in reality, it was what I knew. It was the culture I grew up with. It was what I was most familiar with. And so I felt like God had uniquely gifted me to reach culture like was around me. And so in reaching that, I found that there are a lot of unreached people in rural areas. And a lot of times as people leave for the city, so do good evangelists and trained pastors and planters. And a lot of those people just have an exodus out of rural areas. And so it's not to the detriment of urban centers or suburban areas, but it's just saying that anywhere there are people, they're created in the image of God, and it's important to have ministry there.
Yeah, I love it. I got the same question when Don and I moved to the inner city of Buffalo, New York to plant. We got a lot of people asking, you know, why go there? It was the fastest shrinking city in America at the time. You know, it was the middle of the crack epidemic of the late 80s, early 90s. And yeah, I think in part because I think that the Lord loves forgotten places. I mean, you know, what good can come from Nazareth, you know, that kind of thing. And so when we started the Rural Matters Institute, people ask me, because I'm a city person, right? I there's no seat. My wife calls me city boy. You know, I grew up outside of New York City. I work in Los Angeles County. But I think what's happened is that sometimes when we devalue an area culturally, well, first of all, people in the cultural context know that. They people in the inner city know that they're undervalued by the culture. And people in rural America know that they're undervalued by the culture. And I think ultimately the Lord, as you said, the Imago Dei calls us to everyone. But I'm doing too much talking. I want to hear more from you. But I want to be an advocate for rural ministry, because I think it's counterintuitive that somebody in my role does that, but it really does matter. So talk to us a little bit about your church plant journey as well. You went back to this, was it your hometown? And what was it like planting in a rural context? You know, so much of our church planting methodology is based on ideas of there's a whole lot of people and they're going to value anonymity and they're going to come check out the church. None of that's going to happen in that context. Tell us your story.
Yeah, so I actually didn't plant in my hometown, but my home area. So yeah. I grew up in a town of like 800 people, and lived off the paved road. And growing up, I just was surrounded by poverty. Never even realized that there were vocational pastors in existence, like for most of my even teenage years. And when I ended up in seminary, I actually read your book on church planting, and I was like, wait, you can just start a church? You're allowed to do that?
Wow.
And,
wow.
And Jerry Falwell used to tell students, I went to Liberty Baptist Theological Seminary. He used to tell students, go back to your hometown, start a church. Yep. And pastor it till the day you die. And so he was telling students to do that. And it was just this radical call to young men. And so I was like, man, I could actually do this. And my hometown, I just felt like I knew so many people in every little church there. I just felt like I would break up every church. And so
right.
I just went 30 minutes directly north of where I grew up to a town called Milton, which is where I live now, where we planted New Heights Church. And it's a town of 2,500 people.
Wow.
So felt like
2.5.
Yeah, right. It felt like moving to the big city. A lot of people from my hometown felt like I left to go to the big city to plant a church. And but it was a strategic place for me. So I thought I was using all that strategy that, you know, church planting guys that were writing books about where to go strategically were doing, because Milton's a town on the interstate in West Virginia. And so I was like, hey, this is strategic. And then I go to church planting assessments and they're like, this isn't strategic enough.
Right.
And I was like, wait a minute, anywhere there's people, it should be strategic
That's
enough.
Right.
Anywhere there are people that need to hear the gospel, that should be strategic enough. And so we did it anyways. By the grace of God, we had a lot of help. And so we're 11 years into the church plant now. God's blessed it. And we found a great home close to our original home. And we love it here. We love pastoring Nice. And doing ministry here.
Nice. Well, you know, we're kind of there's always a romanticization of rural America, but there's a reason. I mean, it's a beautiful context and community. So, but you know, part of the thing is most church planting models are based on the idea that you're going to start, you're going to grow enough financially to be self-supporting. You know, and if you have enough population base to draw from, you can get to full-time, you know, ministerial support. You mentioned you hadn't seen anybody in vocational ministry when you were growing up. A lot of bivocationalism. What has it been like for you related to vocation? Just give us the journey.
Yeah. So I hit the ground running and did some fundraising and got support from it was pre-Send Network, but through the North American Mission Board. And so through North American Mission Board support as well as fundraising, I was full time from day one.
Okay.
Again, as a pastor who had not really seen full time ministry that much in
right.
my life, and so I had a congregation of like six people, you know, meeting in my house, and I was like, what do I do with all my time? And so really just became an evangelist and missionary in this small town. But I really felt like it really felt like an anomaly to the town. They were like, well, yeah, but what's your real job?
Right. And, sure. You secretly working for the feds or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I was doing some kind of shady undercover stuff. But
yeah.
as the church continued to grow, of course, I learned, man, this ministry stuff can actually be pretty busy. This can be a pretty full plate. And so we actually have five people on staff at our church now, which in a small town is really crazy. Not a lot of churches have multiple staff like that. But our church is pushing an attendance of 300, which is like a mega church for a town, like I said, of 2,500. And so the size of our church is greater than 10% of the population of the town we meet in. And I think that's very
we tell people that when you get to 10%, you've just done your work, you should quit. So it sounds like accomplished, you have reached Milton, West Virginia. But tell me, I want you to come back to that, but tell me, like, with five staff members, I'm assuming that a church of 300 is not supporting five full-time staff members. So how does that work?
Yeah. So we have three full-time staff members and two part-time staff members. And we don't receive any outside support anymore. We support church plants and send money out. And I think that bivocational ministry is incredibly important as we move forward in planting churches in forgotten areas, rural areas. But I think sometimes guys step into rural church planting and they assume that vocational support won't be there. And that's not always the case. And I think a lot of times in rural areas, you have people that because of the context they're in, maybe because of the poverty levels of where they are, that they assume that the people won't give, but maybe they just haven't been taught that and taught about sacrifice and taught about what the local church should do to support, you know, staff that actually shepherds the people of God. And so we've had to do a lot of teaching on that, but we found that it's been very beneficial to pursue that, but also champion, you know, people that are doing bivocational work. You know, one of our daughter churches that we've planted in the coal fields of West Virginia, the pastor works for the sheriff's department. And so he's working multiple jobs and doing bivocational ministry and doing a great job at it. And so we think it's a both and, not an either or.
Okay, so let's talk some about that. The median income for a household in the town of Milton, West Virginia is $29,348. Median income for a family, $31,000. Per capita is 15,000. So these are 16% of families and 17% of the population are below the poverty line, including 28% of those under 18. So, I mean, this is an economically distressed area. Is that a fair description of the situation?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So what does that look like? I mean, this is something that's, you know, going to be applicable across all contexts, you know, planted in their city, you're dealing with the financial challenges that are there. I think a lot of people would like to know, how did you build a financial base to support three full-time and two part-time staff members? Tell us about that journey and how you teach and preach in around these areas.
Yeah, I think you don't build something that you can't sustain, right? You see what you can sustain at the stage you're at, especially when you're looking at church growth. And so we never tried to like overstaff ourselves beyond what our budget could handle. But we always looked at, as our church grew and as the budget grew, how could we stay in accordance with what we believe? You know, can we continue to add people to reach people? Can we be outwardly focused rather than inwardly focused on just having the programs that we want or the building that we want, or, you know, you fill in the blank. But it's always about teaching faithfulness in a lot of little areas. And so we tell our members, it's not about, we're not trying to shake people down for money or get their W-2s and make sure they're given 10%. But we have a pretty robust membership process, which is unusual for the rural area that we're in. And one of the things that they do when they come into membership in our church is they pledge that they're going to give. And we don't dictate what that is, but we ask them to sign a covenant that they're going to give because it's part of worship. And we say, we just believe that God's called you to do this. And listen, if you're in poverty and you're having trouble paying your bills, one of the beautiful things that we do is we say we believe that the church community exists to pay your bills for you. But that means you have to sacrifice and worship with your giving as well. And so one of the joys of our membership process is what I call the junk drawer promise to our members. Like, you know, the junk drawer that's got like the Bic pens and the scotch tape and the batteries that are dead and all that stuff. We just say, hey, whatever life throws at you, the church is here to help you take care of that. The church in Jerusalem didn't end poverty for the whole city, but they ended poverty among them. And so the Bible says there wasn't a needy person among them. And we believe that should be true of our church. And so it's one of the most attractional things that our church does is people that are in covenant community with our church, we genuinely take care of them. And we do everything we can to do that. And that actually fosters and teaches generosity among our people, even if they're in poverty.
Yeah, fascinating. And a distinction. So let's talk a little bit about one of the things, you know, you were there at that meeting we did in Texas. I think it was Scalise something, Texas. Brian Jarrett was there. I was just, yeah, we, yeah. we created this Rural Matters thing, the Water Tower Network. Real thankful for Brian kind of helping launch that conversation. Still continues, by the way. If you're interested, people can look at the show notes to the Rural Matters Institute. But there's a lot of talk of bivocationalism in that context. Now, you clearly have vocational clergy, we'd technically say that. You're almost sound like you're cautioning people not to think exclusively about bivocationalism. But talk to me a little bit about where is appropriate to do bivocationalism, because it seems that much of rural work is done by bivocational pastors. So talk to us about that, and then kind of the journey you went on as you wrestled through bivocational versus vocational.
Yeah, I think it's necessary. And I think that a lot of the churches that are in, particularly in West Virginia where I'm at, I see the need for bivocational ministers. And so I think church planting is going to have to have a lot of church planters that start out at least bivocational. Normally, it's the other way around. We'll fundraise really good when we're starting a church and have a good prospectus and get people to buy in. But then if it doesn't grow as quickly as we had hoped, then we kind of shrink down to bivocational. I think we might have to begin thinking of doing that the opposite, that we begin bivocational with hopes of one day maybe being vocational. There's another guy planting a church about 2 hours north of us who's bivocational right now, and he's got a prayerful and hopeful budget that he is hoping to grow into that has him as a vocational lead pastor, but they're just not there yet. I think that will become the more wise way to do things, because you're not making assumptions on how quickly the church is going to grow or how big the church is going to grow in the long run. And so I think those are healthy questions to ask, especially when we're starting brand new ministries and we don't know what to expect dropping into new towns, especially in a post-COVID world where the culture is way more polarized. A lot of times in a given location, we don't know how the community is going to react to a new church coming into a given town. Those are elements that I think will lead us into a wiser look at do we begin to plant more churches bivocationally and then just see what God does, right?
Yeah, that's good.
And if the Lord moves and if there's growth, then praise God.
Yeah, so let's talk about the cultural polarization. Are you concerned about Richmond north of Richmond? Has that been the talk of some of the conversation? It's, of course, those you don't know, that Oliver Anthony did a song that kind of went viral to say, I mean, it was crazy. Number one, Billboard Hot 100. Yeah. People say he's Appalachian. He doesn't identify as Appalachian. He's from the Piedmont. But so talk to me a little bit about kind of why people were attracted. Of course, that even become part of the culture war itself, the cultural division itself. But what did that resonate at all with you? Give us some commentary around there.
Yeah, it did. First of all, it's just good music, good Appalachian music. And so thankful for that. I think the message did resonate well. I think what's more interesting is how people reacted to it.
Oh, for sure.
Even some of the interviews with him, he was just like, he's like, everyone's taking this wrong, right? But like right. Everyone gets so amped up about their views and opinions of it, right? And I think it's indicative of the polarization that's in our culture. It's just like everything pushes us far to the right or far to the left. And, I'm just over here pushing 300 pounds, eating fudge rounds and feeling judged a little bit. But that lyric didn't bother me because I'm 6'6". So he says, if you're 5'3" and 300 pounds.
Just so there's, I don't know that everyone knows the level of the detail of the song, but that was a part of the song, actually a controversial part of the song and a part of the song I didn't find particularly helpful for his message, but it's basically talking about people cheating welfare. And that, push back on that part. But I think I don't want people to miss that. There's a sense of being left behind and mm-hmm. an unfair world that's there. And I do wonder, so how does that work for, rural America really has been unhappy, and it's hard to speak in generalizations, but has known that it's been ignored and left behind and marginalized. And sometimes people just speak dismissively of it and spoke up and saying no more. Songs like this kind of speak to that. How does that work? Because that also, I mean, there are people going to get upset. And how do you navigate that in your church so they can be on mission? They can be in a community of people who may have different opinions. How does that work?
Well, and here's my take. And if you don't like it, you can just listen to the next episode and
we'll just edit it out.
Be done with it. Yeah, there you go. My take is we have to take that angst that exists that you hear in a song like that and the response to a song like that, things that go viral like that. You see the angst that exists and the anger and the frustration of rural people, the feeling that they're left behind. And what's happening is they tend to look for it in a political revival rather than a gospel one. And I believe the church has the answer to those things, but it's not found in the physical realm. The answer that a lot of rural people are looking for is not all their bills being paid and them having an easier life, but the answer is in the gospel. It's in a spiritual answer, not a physical one. And so when we meet people where they are and say, hey, our world might suck, we might have a lot of really difficult things, but the answer that is better than that is a spiritual and eternal one. And you can actually find that hope in the community of a local church. I think that's what people are lacking in their lives. And that can actually reduce some of the angst and anger. Not to say political or social issues don't matter, but the gospel certainly matters more. Yeah. And when we mingle those and we kind of forget the gospel or lump it in with those things instead of keeping it above those things, I think we're misguided and we just become part of the noise and chatter of, you know, Twitter or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. We've gone a little long because I think it's just a fascinating conversation, but I'm interested, you know, you've got a town of 2,500 with 300 people coming to church on Sunday, which probably you've got 300 people on a given Sunday. You probably got 600 to 700 people engaged in the life of your church. So it's clearly not just Milton, but around that as well. So at what point does it feel big and how do you navigate that? I'm guessing you're the biggest church in town now.
Yeah, we are. And it does feel big. And we're actually, we have two services and we bought a building and we're getting ready to move to one service. And so it's going to feel a lot bigger. And I'm actually doing some leadership coaching and my coach was talking to me. He was like, what have you done to prepare your people, you know, that are Appalachian people to adjust to that? It's going to feel like just such a big church service and they don't like that or they're not used to being in any gathering that big. And I was like, well, I haven't really done anything to prepare him. And he's like, you better start. And so we're working on that. But just trying to teach people that like in a sea of faces, like you're not forgotten. God knows you. And actually celebrate it. It is good that this many people want to center their lives on the gospel. And God has raised up a force to be reckoned with that hell can't stop. And you can reach so many more people in these small communities that you live in. And we can plant so many more churches. And so we're trying to celebrate it and champion it and just keep the momentum going. But I'm not overly optimistic either. I don't want to be unrealistic. And I realize that churches are going to plateau and we're 11 years in and, you know, we're probably coming close to that. And so I want to even think in longevity, how can we continue to give birth to daughter churches, plant more churches, so that the legacy is just bigger than what our, you know, singular local church could be.
Fascinating conversation, helpful conversation. As you're hopefully listening, let's remember that God is at work in rural contexts and God calls people there. Maybe you called there, partner with others are going to call to reach there as well. We're thankful for the good work of Will Basham. Will, thanks for taking time to be with us on the New Churches podcast.
Yeah, really happy to be here. Thanks, man.
You've been listening to the New Churches podcast, brought to you by Send Network. If you like what you heard, take a few minutes to rate and review us or share this episode with a friend. It's the best way to show your support. To find more reliable resources to start your new church well, visit newchurches.com.